training the people up here on the platform. I have given out a number of 3x5 cards. There are more in the back. If you have questions that arise during this time, or perhaps even situations that you're thinking of, or whatever may be the case, you can write them down or see us afterward, and tomorrow the time will be spent answering those specific questions. We want to cover as much ground as we can. We want to answer all the questions that we can. So please ask, whatever you want to ask, feel free to do that. If you have any doubts or anything that strikes you, this is your opportunity to raise the question. Now, basically, those questions ought to be raised specifically on the Worldwide Church of God, although if you ask us some, we'd be glad to answer them too. But for the most part, we're looking for a good understanding of where the Worldwide Church of God is at this point. And that's what we're looking for. We want to clarify as much as possible, answer as much as possible, and make it very clear to you. Let's begin with prayer, and then I'll introduce the members, and we'll begin. Father, we're just thankful that we can meet together and discuss a subject like this. It is so rare in history to see a religious movement make such a transformation. And though there are questions and doubts that reside, yet, Lord, we just pray that you would help us to gain good understanding, to be open and free as we would discuss with each other. So I ask for your blessing on our time. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Let me introduce the members from the Worldwide Church of God. On my left, on your right, Greg Albrecht, who is the Director of Church Relations and Plain Truth Ministries. He is also the Editor-in-Chief of Plain Truth Magazine. This is Greg over here. And then the President, Pastor General of the Worldwide Church of God, Joseph Catch, over here. If you have not read the book that he has written on the movement and the changes transformed by truth, you might want to pick that up and read it, because in it is much of the journey of what the Worldwide Church of God has gone through. It's really a great book. The foreword is by Hank Hanegraaff. And if you want to know more about the story, even beyond what is said today, please feel free to pick up that book. My name is Jim Bjornstedt. I am president of EMNR, but I teach philosophy, professor of philosophy at Sudeville College in Sudeville, Ohio. I don't want to tell you how long I've been in cult ministry, but I started with Roland Martin in 1964, I figured out today. That's a long time, isn't it? I was there when EMNR began and a host of other things. They call me the granddaddy in the sense now of this movement right here, of these guys. But I feel aged when I come here. Well, even when I hear 20 years of ministry, I'm saying, oh, I feel even older. But that's why I'm up here, I guess. My hair is not gray, it's white, caused by students mostly. But I will moderate this, and I hope not ask too many questions or intervene. I'll go by Jim, that way we can allow James to be James. And James Walker is president of Watchman Fellowship. He's a fourth generation Mormon, but now ex-Mormon. Well, what am I going to do? Because I wasn't in anything. I was a sinner, that's right. A former sinner. But I still sin, so what's the difference? This is James Walker from Watchman Fellowship. And then John Moorhead, the executive vice president of Truth Quest Institute, former Reorganized Church Latter-day Saints, and also a board member of EMNR, and these are our members from EMNR that we'll be questioning. I thought the way to begin would be to have the members from the Worldwide Church of God give you something of what the Worldwide Church of God was like 20, 30 years ago, and to summarize for you the theology even at that time. And then what I'd like them to do is to tell you when the change began and how the journey has gone along in this to bring us to where we are today, and then to explain what the theology is today of the Worldwide Church of God. I think that'll lay the background for what we need to discuss.
1964, I was 12 years old, and... I'll discuss what it was like to be 12 years old in the Worldwide Church of God, because that's some 30-some years ago. We had, as I think you all know, some fairly aberrant teachings that you would find in the fringes of Christianity if you examine the totality of Christian history. And so we would have believed that British Israelism was a special key, and I think everyone knows what British Israelism is, the idea that the United States and Western Europe, Canada, and certain other nations comprised the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And that was seen as a key to unlocking biblical prophecy. And we would have been staunch and firm believers in British Israelism, although we wouldn't call it British Israelism. Because that's a very racist teaching, and we tried to believe in it without the racist component. We would have believed that God is a family comprised of the Father and the Son, and that our ultimate destiny is to be God as God is God and flesh out the rest of his family, so to speak, but not in the flesh, in the spirit. We've been staunchly anti-Trinitarian. In fact, some of the kids I grew up with in the church thought that pagan anti-Trinity doctrine was all one word. So we were staunchly anti-Trinitarian. We would have believed that the Catholic Church was the great whore of Revelation 17, and that all the Protestant churches were the harlot daughters of the great whore, and all deceived, and Christians falsely so-called, is the way we would often phrase it in our literature. We would have adhered strictly to the laws of purity that you find in Leviticus, clean and unclean meats. We were anti-Christmas and anti-Easter. We were devotedly Sabbatarian and taught and practiced that you must observe holy time from sunset Friday to sunset Saturday. In fact, I lost a job or two over the course of my lifetime over that issue. And those, aside from mentioning the British Israelism as the key to prophecy, our publications offered sort of the approach of having the newspaper in one hand and the Bible in the other and interpreting all of events in light of the Bible. And we had booklets on just
a church in the sense that, in terms of the way it was founded and the way it grew. It was not planted. It was a media church. And in some respects, as some of you know, Herbert Armstrong was quite a pioneer in the use of media and radio and television. So the church essentially became those people who responded to Herbert Armstrong's media efforts through his radio program, later his television program in the early 50s, and his literature, including Plain Truth Magazine, so that, for instance, if 20 or 25 people responded and wrote letters to Herbert Armstrong in Pasadena, California, from Fargo, North Dakota, then Herbert Armstrong would assign a messenger
for prophecy.
We didn't think of that, otherwise we would
have. Yeah, if we'd have thought of it, we'd have published one on that, too. I think, fairly well characterized. We had churches in about 120 countries. We never had a membership of much beyond 120,000, although our attendance worldwide did reach about 140,000-150,000 people at its peak.
Before you go on, let me just add that the church at the time that Joe is describing it, when he was 12 years of age, and I was just a little bit older than him, but we won't go into that at that time, a little bit, was not simply for that group of people, a younger minister, to Fargo, North Dakota, to begin to start a church there. And a minister would go there, rent a building, and begin to hold services. And so it was very much of a media empire that grew into a church. And in fact, in the very beginning, I don't think Herbert Armstrong really wanted a church. He wanted a media empire. And that's kind of the way we started now.
That's well said. A few other items that are worth mentioning, too. A lot of things that were practiced, let's say, as part of the holiness movement in church history, were things that Herbert Armstrong also latched on to. He was very much a man of his times in the literature he was reading. So women in our denomination, most points through it, would not wear makeup, even at some points wouldn't wear pants or slacks. So there were some of those kinds of issues as well. Faith in healing was an idealistic teaching. And this varied according to the pastor in the congregation, but some pastors wouldn't anoint someone who would request it if they were going to go to a doctor. And going to doctors or seeking professional help was seen as a lack of faith. Some pastors were very hot on that and would refuse to visit someone in a hospital if they were there. Others weren't. Others would denounce you even though you were going to a doctor. And I think it's important to recognize up front that Armstrongism isn't and wasn't monolithic. Often all these beliefs tend to get painted with one broad brush, and that's far from reality. Depending on what year a person came to the Worldwide Church of God, depending on what years their pastor went through Ambassador College, and what college they went to, because we had three different colleges to go to, would determine what stream or brand of Armstrongism that pastor would teach or preach in his pastorate. So that's pretty much how it was. We saw ourselves as the one and only true church, and everyone else was deceived.
Let me just, one more thing that might help, since you folks are in countercult ministries. Herbert Armstrong became acquainted with a woman, actually his wife, Herbert Armstrong's wife, Loma, who was a member of the Church of God Seventh Day, who came out of, though they liked to paint an independent existence, they were essentially an Adventist offshoot in the mid part of the 1800s, early on in Adventism, admittedly, but still an offshoot of Adventism, which itself came out of the Millerite great disappointment. So Herbert Armstrong, before that time, had been a Quaker, but a nominal Quaker. And his wife, I believe, a Methodist. Herbert Armstrong himself was baptized by a Baptist minister. As he came to see his wife's belief, and his wife, in turn, of course, had been ministered to by this Church of God Seventh-day woman, and the Sabbath played a very important part of that, the Sabbath truth, as Adventists and Armstrongites will call it. Herbert Armstrong came into religion without a lot of formal training, in fact, without any formal training, and this is something that characterizes all of the Armstrongite groups today. They're eclectic. They have taken, through Herbert Armstrong, a little bit from here, a little bit from Jehovah's Witnesses, a little bit of Mormon thought, a little bit of Joe mentioned, while you may or may not like to hear this, from the fringest, we always took the most bizarre and fringe teachings from fundamentalism. He liked dispensationalism, hooked up dispensationalism with British Israelism. It was a great 1-2 counterpunch combo. And usually got him to be converted into Armstrongism. Dispensationalism and British Israelism is a wicked little fear number you could play on people. The teachings, therefore, came from a broad base, but without any systematic, methodological, logical framework. And that's important to understand, because when you try to get a grip on Armstrongism, it's kind of like trying to get a hold of a greasy pig in a barnyard. You're going everywhere, because there's nothing that always leads you back logically to one basis of reasoning. And Herbert Armstrong became, in his early writings, he wasn't this way, he became the one and only true apostle, never before understood since the first century. All these truths were lost from the first century until 1934, when Herbert Armstrong started his ministry. This was all the rhetoric and the hype, and that grew as his movement grew and became more and more outlandish and preposterous, to where he even at times called himself and referred to himself as Elijah. One of our ministers, after hearing him call himself Elijah, went to him and said, "Mr. Armstrong, are you sure that you're saying are you like Elijah, or are you actually Elijah, the Elijah to come?" Whom we would probably know as John the Baptist, but Mr. Armstrong affirmed that he felt he was Elijah. That came later in his life. The older he got, and the more people around him who began to say to him, feed his ego, "Yes, you are." He didn't have someone like some of the Caesars, who, when they made a pronouncement, would come up to him right after he made a pronouncement and whisper in his ear, "Remember, Caesar, thou too art human." Herbert Armstrong didn't have that. And so the ego grew, and the claims grew through the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
In the 1970s, I think there's 1 minute worth of mentioning, since there was no systematic theology, an attempt was made to systematize all of Herbert W. Armstrong's teachings. And it was seen or portrayed by some as a liberal movement because it made a few changes. Those few changes were: people were told that it's okay to celebrate birthdays, it's okay to for women to wear makeup, and voting was okay. You know, it's all right to participate in politics. And that was about the extent of the changes that 1970s systematic theology project yielded. There were no other changes in it. It was staunchly anti-Trinitarian, taught tithing and good works as a way to maintain your salvation. Herbert Armstrong renounced that systematic theology project, and in a letter recalled the notebooks that were sent out to all the pastors, and they all had to send them back in. In the letter that recalled those notebooks, he said that it was 95% accurate, but this 5% of intellectual leaven ruined the whole thing, so he recalled them.
In the early 80s, we called the Systematic Theology Project slowly turning Protestant. Slowly turning Protestant.
Yeah.
That's the way it was labeled, and that pejorative pretty well put it in its place. And that was the end of that.
Yeah. 1986, January, was when Herbert Armstrong died. Prior to his death, interesting that there were a number of people, not a large number, but a few people who would visit with him every day. And my dad was in that group of people. And he told my dad on a couple occasions privately that there were things that needed to be changed. He wasn't very specific on those things, but he was specific on one issue. And he said, "The way we teach healing and going to doctors is not accurate. People shouldn't feel that it's a lack of faith to go to doctors, and you need to fix that." He said, "There'll be the other things you'll need to change." And he was non-specific about what those items were. My dad was then selected as his chosen successor, and the board seemed to appreciate that, although there were half a dozen that privately thought they should have been the successor, and they expressed that at one time or another to people. But things managed to hold together. My dad was more of a management type person, worked in assembly lines and in a supervisory capacity, so he introduced a level of management expertise that heretofore didn't exist in the Worldwide Church of God. And some were even hailing it the first few years of my dad's tenure as the golden years of the church, because he did eventually say, you know, makeup is okay for women to wear, and voting's okay, and some of these issues that in the 70s were given and then taken back were once again explained and given. And
just say what you had your thoughts. The other thing that in these early years that Joseph Tkach did, by the way, Joseph Tkach, a native of Chicago, and maybe Joe will talk about that a little bit more about his family. Joe himself grew up here. But the other thing that he did in these early years of 86, 87, 88, began to recognize employees for their service. He began to institute health insurance for the church, which we had not had before, again, linked to doctrine, bad doctrine, not going to a doctor. And he began to even talk out loud formally about having a pension plan. And there was no need to have a pension plan because we were all going to be taken to, as we called it, a place of safety, our version of the rapture before the tribulation. In our version, it was 3.5 years, not 7, and before Jesus would return. And since you didn't need to retire, you wouldn't need a retirement program, so all those years with all the millions spent in media, there was no retirement program. And Joseph Tkach Sr. began to talk about that. And so when Joe talks about the golden years, there were some things there that members and employees really identified with because they hadn't been recognized so much as human beings before, and Joe's dad began to do that.
And as well, a lot of the maverick style of pastoring that was allowed to exist while Herbert Armstrong was president began to be addressed under my dad's tenure. 1986, in the fall of the year, was when I came to work for the church. And we had a theme that people need to be shepherds, not sheriffs, in terms of pastoral ministry. And it was quite a concerted effort to correct some of the totalitarian types that were in the pastorate. Moving ahead then, 1988 would have been when we fixed, let's say, the healing doctrine that doctors are okay to go to, and we'd explained that Herbert Armstrong had recognized something was wrong with his teaching, asked that it be looked into and fixed. And in doing that, we showed where he had taught some errors. And this was a crack in the dike, if I could phrase it that way for you. Because some people had their first awareness that Herbert Armstrong, the one and only true apostle in the end time, as many viewed him, could be wrong about something. And thereafter, we made more changes as we saw things were in error. And each time there was a change, it made the crack bigger. And that's when we encountered our first split. A group that calls himself the Philadelphia Church of God, led by a fellow named Gerald Flurry, left and took probably 3,000 people with him. And he was going to uphold Armstrongism and started teaching that my dad was the false prophet. He was the fulfillment of the man of sin. And then we started to make some more changes, the big one being the Trinity.
Born again, yeah. Let me just interject before Joe goes on with this to share with you something which perhaps some countercult ministries don't know. And that is Gerald Flurry has chosen over the last several years to willfully ignore copyright law. And he has taken all of the literature, or much of the literature, that we no longer print, distribute, publish, written by Herbert Armstrong, and reprinted it and begun to redistribute it. Our position is this. Number one, we own the copyright because Herbert Armstrong was an employee of the Worldwide Church of God. That's, if I was talking to a group of lawyers, that's our position. But number two, since we're talking ecclesiastically, we also have a position that that teaching is flawed and leads to all kinds of bad stuff. Therefore, we don't want it disseminated. Gerald Flurry has taken Herbert Armstrong's magnum opus called Mystery of the Ages, in which all of his teachings were kind of combined and written just about a year or so before his death, and has reprinted and redistributed that, changing only one thing in the book. Every word is exactly as it is, changing only one thing, and that is in the title page where it said, copyright, Worldwide Church of God. He put copyright, Herbert W. Armstrong. Now, we are in litigation with Mr. Flurry's church right now. Why? Because we don't want that literature out there. But he has distributed some 50,000 copies, I believe, printed and distributed. And the courts so far have not seen fit because his position is that First Amendment, he's arguing First Amendment. And he's arguing that we've abandoned this literature. So I think it's only right, and I'm not trying to pat ourselves on the back, to share with you what we are trying to do in relationship to some of that material. But the court has not ruled yet. And it looks like it's been a long and painful process thus far. And we hope we will win. And if we don't, we would expect every publisher in the country to line up behind us because copyright law has been broken. But that is an ongoing situation right now, kind of interrupted. And
yeah, the only way we would want that literature out there is if it was heavily annotated with big lines pointing to the statements in error. As we then continue to make changes, the embracing of the Trinity was sort of a final brick that was pulled out of the dike, and that change spawned some more splits in the denomination. It was a very difficult time because in counter-cult ministry, I well appreciate that some were wanting to report what's going on inside the Worldwide Church of God. And I appreciate the position that you would have people calling, saying, should I keep going here, or I have relatives, should I press hard now for them to leave? I appreciate the kind of position you would be in trying to give advice to those people. And I think it's sad that we didn't have a better working relationship over that course of time, because what tended to happen was our own credibility, as we're trying to lead our people out of the error, was our own credibility was being undermined. So this is a thing that was done not by Joseph Tkach or Greg Albrecht or Mike Fazell or whoever else we might name in our organization. This was something that was done by God. If anything, we got in the way, and when I say we, I mean all of we, the collective we. But I very much appreciate God's sovereignty and how he has moved. Where we are today is that we couldn't continue to have the kind of division in our congregations where probably about a third of our ministers or our pastors would refuse to teach the doctrine of our church, but instead wanted to continue teaching Armstrongism. A very difficult issue to deal with. In some cases, we had congregations complaining, saying, throw this pastor out. In other cases, we had pastors trying to persuade the entire congregation to leave with him. And so it was just almost anarchy at times. And it was very hard to answer questions. We had no agenda for change. Those of us who were in leadership would try to teach the changes as we understood them, and we understood that there were more things wrong than we could hope to understand at that at any one point in time. So it was like you're in a car and someone put a brick on the accelerator, and all you could do was hang on to the steering wheel. And that best describes my experience through the changes. There are other, just as a sidebar to this, there are other Sabbatarian denominations that are going through this very identical thing right now. And I think what's best for them is for them not to get press coverage and try to scoop what's going on inside. Let's trust God to do what he knows how to do. And I'm excited to see that in other Sabbatarian denominations that this earthquake that happened in our denomination is spreading to the other Sabbatarian denominations.
One thing that you may be interested in, and I'll just insert it right now, and we can talk about it more if you have questions about it. I'll use my own case as an example. How did this personally come about? How did people come to Christ within the movement of Armstrongism? I'll give you a 4 to 5 minute testimony, though some experts say you should be able to do it in about 60 seconds. And in doing so, be sure to name the exact place in front of your garage, 2:35 a.m. Saturday morning. So I won't be able to do all that in about 4 or 5 minutes. When Hubert Armstrong died in 1986, I remember very clearly standing by the graveside and looking at his coffin and knowing that he was now dead. This man who had so ordered my life, I knew that my worldview was in incredible upheaval. I didn't know how much upheaval it was in. I didn't know where I was going to go. I didn't know how confused I was, but I knew that things were going to change. For those of you from the 60s, Peter, Paul, and Mary, blowing in the wind, you know, I knew that was going on. Didn't know what to make of it. Within a couple of years after that, by, say, 88 or 89, I was fully aware that I was disgusted at my life, in terms of the way I had ordered my life. It played out in my life in the sense of my family, my job, my relationship with my wife, all the people whose lives I touched. I was one of our more controlling and conservative people. And my job had always been to control people. I had been told by my denomination, by my church, by Hubert Armstrong, that my job as a husband was to control my wife, that my job as a parent was to control my children. My job as a dean of students in our college, where I served for 12 years, 20 years on the faculty, and as dean for 12, was to control the students. As a pastor, to control the members. And by about 88, I found out that I wasn't even able to control my own life, let alone anybody else. That everything was just spinning out of control, and somehow I wasn't controlling things. It wasn't working. This whole system of working hard and trying to qualify and trying to be good enough and all of those kinds of things, the system was flawed somehow. I was led to a study of British Israelism for some strange reason. It wasn't the Trinity. It wasn't the deity of Jesus Christ. It wasn't salvation by grace through faith. It was British Israelism I began to study. And I am very confident that Jesus was leading me to the cross. And I came to Christ. I cannot give you an exact day or month or year, and if that troubles you, I'm sorry. But I happen to know many Christians who cannot tell you that either. But I came to Christ in a way I'd never known him before. I knew a lot of things and information and bits of facts about him, but I did not know him as personal Lord and Savior. That troubles some to whom I administered before. It troubles some whom I had baptized or counseled or performed their wedding ceremony. But I'm sorry. I just have to say that I came to that, and I had not experienced that before. Some would say, well, then you were converted. You gave your heart to the Lord. You were born again for the first time. I don't know exactly what label to put on that experience, but the experience was that I knew him as I never knew him before, and that happened by somewhere in the early 90s. It came through an incredible period of pain, of anguish, of hurt, because families, friends, people didn't understand me. They thought it was a midlife crisis, but there was no red sports car. I rode my bike around a lot and thought a lot as I was on a bike. It was red, but that's as close as I got to a red sports car. But there was a lot of pain because people who were my lifelong friends and even family members, none of my immediate family, not my wife or two children, thankfully, but others, just simply decided I was crazy and I had gone completely wacko, completely Protestant, syrupy about Jesus. What's all this Jesus stuff? That type of thing. And it was a very alone feeling. And through this, in the late 80s, though I don't think I'd really come to Christ as I did in the early 90s, several of us began, and one thing you don't do in a cult, you do not tell people what you really think, because if you do, then you're out of there on your ear, or worse, on another part of your body. You have to very carefully and tentatively seek out and search out and test with little questions and little sibboleth or shibboleths to see if they really know what they're talking about and if they really accept you. And then you test them and see if they'll report you by giving them a little information. It's kind of like spy and counter spy and whatever. And slowly and surely, some of us, like Joe and Mike Fizell, who's not here, began to befriend one another and began to slowly both share and then later on become accountable. And we learned in forming some small groups some years after that what accountability was about as men of God. So that was my experience, and through all of that, I had to deal with the issue of Herbert W. Armstrong, who he was, what he taught, what he did to me, and I finally came to the point where I was not raging and pointing the finger at Herbert Armstrong as being the one who had ruined my life. I had to finally come to the point of looking myself in the mirror and say, Greg, you're a big boy. At one time in your life, you accepted all that teaching. You were the one who decided that you would follow it, teach it, preach it, proclaim it, carry it on. So you better look at yourself as well. So that's part of the story, and if you like a testimony, I'll share it with you.
Only one other point maybe to cover in terms of how these changes in a physical sense occurred. Under Herbert Armstrong's tenure, there was a personnel correspondence department that was charged with answering any letters or questions or challenges that would come in about the teachings. There were some questions or challenges that would be received and just thrown away. The approach being, well, let's just consider the source. This is from either the harlot daughter or the great harlot herself, so let's not bother answering. When he died and my dad took over, his policy was different. His policy was, hey, if we have the truth, let's stand up for the truth and defend it, and let's answer all questions. So Mike, Greg, and I, and a few others, were charged with the responsibility of answering all these challenges that would come in. Now, we weren't real organized in how we did that. I would get letters that... being in charge of a pastoral ministry, most of the letters would come my way, and sometimes there'd be too many, and I'd farm some out to Greg or to Mike or give someone some letters to get to Mike or get to Greg so that I didn't have to answer them all. Of course, this set me on a course of study, and what I found was that we were wrong. And as I saw we were wrong, at first I thought, now what am I going to do? I'm in this position where I don't agree with some of the teachings of our church, and this was mainly dealing with the Trinity. And, boy, I don't want to create a scandal for my father, and maybe I can quietly resign and go away someplace. Eventually,
which would have been a good decision.
Which, yeah. And Greg said it would have been a good decision, then I wouldn't have had to deal with all the grief that has followed. But nevertheless, I'm pleased that this is the journey that the Lord has brought me on. But as I was answering these questions and seeing that I was at odds with some of our teachings, eventually I reached out to Greg and Mike and saw that they were on the same page. And then had a discussion with my dad about some of these issues and said, look, you know, you want us to answer all these questions, and the problem is to answer some of these, especially on the issue of the Trinity, we're going to have to acknowledge we're wrong. So my dad embraced that immediately and said, yeah, then what we need to do is organize this. Let's teach all our ministry first where we were wrong and that the Trinity is right, and then they can teach our membership. We tried to have a confidential two-week session with all the leading ministers in Pasadena. And to show you how well that worked, at the first break, after we said we need to keep this confidential, we're going to go through 2 weeks of training and discussion here and answer all the questions. First day, the first break, they were out making phone calls, warning people, telling people the primal forces are being shaken. And so there was no confidentiality. And so thereafter, in any book I would check out of the library, if someone could see what it was, they would predict that was the next change that's going to occur in the church. So that's physically how it started. We were answering questions, and my dad had a dream that we could go methodically, slowly, and answer everybody's questions, but as I tried to explain to him, that's just really a dream. People ask questions, and you have to answer their questions, and one question leads to another question, and you can't say, look, we're not going to answer questions for a year. You got to answer the questions, and that's why I say the metaphor is like the brick put on the accelerator, and questions just poured in, and we answered them the best we could at the time, and never really could foresee all the changes that were going to occur on down the road. It's a mistake to view this in terms completely of a hierarchical, top-down driven change. Simultaneously, to the leadership, let's say, recognizing the errors and trying to organize a way to correct it, there's an equal grassroots movement. People who, have very active devotional lives, praying half an hour to an hour a day, that was always something Armstrong taught very forcefully should be done. I believe God answered some of those prayers. And people were having maybe their own Aldersgate experiences individually and writing in saying, I understand what you're saying, and been praying for this for a year now. And there were just as many people in the pews who arose to the challenges as there were in the hierarchy, so to speak, who were trying to organize it. So I don't know if that's a sufficient summary, but we're happy to answer any questions.
Yeah.